To the contrary is supported in part by the Cardinal Health Foundation, funding national programs that enhance patient safety and access to quality health care services. Additional funding provided by the E. Rhodes and Leona B. Carpenter Foundation, the Jacob and Valeria Langeloth Foundation, the David Lynch Foundation, the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, and by the Ayrshire Foundation.
This week on To the Contrary, will a female voter backlash against mainstream media's treatment of Senator Hillary Clinton continue in upcoming primaries? Then, pregnant high school teens want maternity leave. Behind the headlines, networking Latina style on the internet. Hello, I'm Bonnie Urbe. Welcome to the Contrary, a discussion of news and social trends from diverse perspectives. Up first, sisterhood seems powerful once again.
A female voter backlash against media bashing of Senator Clinton? If so, will that sustain her through the next few primaries in Michigan, Nevada, and South Carolina? Is that what triggered this week's win in New Hampshire for Senator Clinton?
The media, in covering a presidential campaign, clearly is not willing to be overtly racist, but they are willing to be overtly sexist.
A large pickup of support among younger women voters was the driving force behind her surprise New Hampshire victory after they deserted her in Iowa the week before. Clinton captured 46% of the overall women's vote in the Granite State and defeated Senator Obama by 30 points among women over 65. But the key difference between Senator Clinton's win in New Hampshire and loss in Iowa was the younger women's vote.
In Iowa, Senator Clinton carried married women, for example, but there just weren't that many married women who voted in Iowa because it was such a narrow range of time. Basically, you had to be there during the dinner hour, which limited the number of women who could come out. New Hampshire, the entire day was available for regular voting, so you could find time to go. I think it made it a lot easier for women of all ages to get to the polls, and I do think that made a difference for her.
On the Republican side, the race is still wide open after Senator John McCain's win in New Hampshire thanks to the support of independents. Women favored McCain over Romney, but only by 8 points.
So, Megan Beyer, will the women who joined Hillary in the New Hampshire primary stick with her in the upcoming primaries?
Here's what I've learned, Bonnie. People like us on shows like this should stay away from speculation like that.
Well, it looks like the younger women still have gone for Obama, so women are split.
Well, if Hillary really found her voice in New Hampshire and that was a voice that connected with women, I think she can stick and have both groups support.
I think we know by now you can't put women in a box because we are too nuanced and too unpredictable.
All right, so what happened? What was the difference between Iowa and New Hampshire in terms of women for Hillary Clinton? And will whatever that change was, will it continue into Nevada and Michigan and South Carolina, the upcoming primary?
That's the big question. I think there's so much speculation about what happened. You didn't have polling that continued. You know, there's a lot of the misty-eyed comment. But there's an interesting
thing. Right, there was the misty-eyed comment. There was Senator Obama's response to her, which is, you're likable enough, Hillary, which did that upset women and drive them over.
And don't you know, I have to say that it's not the Obama's response so much as the moderator's question on likability. That's a very personal question, and I have to ask, if you asked that to an African-American candidate, people would have been jarred. So why is it okay? Not that I sound like a feminist now, but I am a conservative economic feminist. But, you know, it's something that questioned the treatment of women. And I will say this, sometimes voters send a message. If you go back to 1992, Ross Perot voters, 20 million, sent a message on the deficit. The government needs to pay attention. This could be a case where you say, you know what, treat all candidates fairly. That's what I want to see.
Bill Clinton some credit. He was out there hammering on that last day. So Hillary went soft, he went tough. That's a good
combination. There were a lot of things going on, and I think if we decide we are going to look at this race through the prism of only gender and race, we do a disservice not only to the candidates, but to the process, to our democracy.
Well, I mean, do you really think America has gotten to the point where they don't see the candidates at least as a factor? She is, after all, and would be the first woman president if she got the nomination and won the White House. He would be the first African-American. It is a factor.
But I think we need to step back a little bit, because a lot of people have been saying, oh, everybody on television, they were being sexist. That's what it was all about when they were coronating Obama after Iowa. Well, they were doing something similar to Hillary before Iowa, and it's not like Hillary Clinton is just a woman. Hillary Clinton is also somebody these reporters have been covering for the last 15 years. They've been covering their operatives. And I think that Andrea Mitchell said it. This could be a passing of the torch. They were very excited about this idea for change. So I think we have to be careful when we're calling people sexist and racist.
I have to say that I totally agree with Megan, because when I was watching everything unfold on television, I kept saying, you know, as a woman of color who's worked very hard to diversify the workforce, I'm like, my God, candidates are substantive, that have records. So yes, gender and race will be an issue, but on top of it, we're not compromising on quality with these two candidates.
Right. Well, I heard one noted polling expert say on national media that why the polls were so wrong, to the extent they were, the way the media spun them, was because of race, because there's still this issue hanging out there about voters saying they will support Obama, and then they turn around and they don't, and race does become
the pundits. I think the pundits made it. I think the pundits went too far in crucifying Hillary, saying that her campaign was over. And you read article after article, particularly by feminists that for a long time were saying, oh, we're going to do Obama, we're not going to go for Hillary, she's not feminist enough, saying enough is enough.
There was a change in women's vote. She did get more middle-aged women support. What triggered that? Will it sustain itself?
Look, I think there's no question that we have heard repeatedly that people in New Hampshire weren't sure where they were going to go. This is not within the Democratic Party. There's really no difference on ideology. It's really about how they're reacting to these candidates, and it goes up and down. So I think that one has to be very measured about interpreting this. I think that it would be a real shame, though, if we come out of New Hampshire saying this is all going to be about women and all going to be about race, because the great thing is, up until now, that has not been the case.
I totally agree. I think we have to be much more prudent. I think we all have to take a breath and let this race occur. We have a redo. You know, we got Iowa, we got New Hampshire. Let's go in with, you know, maybe not being so willing to crucify somebody, to react so quickly, to listen to these pundits and these polls, thinking that, you know, it doesn't matter what the people do. We know already. We're not psychics. You know, we are supposed to be reporting what is happening.
Okay, well, I'm asking you to be a psychic in this way, which is Starbucks crowd for Obama and the blue collar crowd and older women for Hillary. What explains that? I mean, if anything,
they both went
to Yale Law School. They're both elitists, let's face it, in different ways.
And both very bright, wonderful candidates. I agree. Well, I was in Iowa. And I knocked on a lot of doors, and I can tell you, I was in blue-collar neighborhoods, and I saw lots of support across the board. We have been to two small states with two relatively small samples of voting patterns. As I say, I think we need to be prudent. I think we need to let this race evolve. And in fact, I was on a conference call this week. I'm part of the Obama campaign. And Barack Obama said that. He said, you know, if we had come out of this with two dominoes, suddenly we win the nomination. He said, you know, that wouldn't have been fair to the American people. We need to let this democracy play out.
You know, one thing that we do know for sure is that women voters are going to, again, be swing voters in very important states. They are going to have an impact on how they decide.
The majority, they will control it, essentially.
Women, well, they
by 5 percentage points, not beyond the margin of error,
exactly,
so to speak.
George Bush closed that gap. I just want to remind everybody from a big one. But, you know, no doubt about it, women are going to play a pivotal role, married women. The breakdown, we will start to see that breakdown again. Dr. Healy's right. You don't see it on the Republican side right now, but you definitely see it on the Democratic side. But keep in
Why
mind.
Why don't you see it on the Republican side?
Yeah. Ideology is very strong. And with women, it tends to be, you know, you're looking at likability and electability. And there's a lot of that going back and forth between these two candidates. What's fascinating, though, is people will sometimes look beyond. Hillary Clinton has a whole list of things people can be critical of with her record. And, you know, there's a long understanding of who Hillary Clinton is in people's mind. And she's right. trying to rebrand that. So she's going to have a tougher time in the general election. But women voters, I do have to say, did respond to kind of this feeling of unfair treatment. I do think that is one thing we will find out of New Hampshire.
You know, something that's not getting focus and should, and this is nonpartisan, is that so few men came out. You had 57% women, only 43% of men voted. Where are the fellas?
Because they tend to, they are more Republican than women tend to be by 10 to 20 points, so therefore the gender gap. They are less energized this season, are they not?
But isn't that amazing? It used to be, you know, maybe 51, 49. But for men to stay home, I mean, this is not good for the country.
Maybe, you know, the Republican Party
like
has to do a better job of energizing them. But one question I do want to address, because we touched on it, but I really want to examine it. The teary-eyed moment. Okay, there was so much written about, you know, women, man candidates in tears. My first reaction was she didn't really tear up. I mean, she certainly didn't have tears.
But she was emotional. But
that is quite different from Edmund Muskie with tears. He said snow, but everybody there said tears rolling down his cheeks. Or even, to the contrary, panel member Pat Schroeder had tears rolling down her cheeks.
But this is Hillary Clinton. She's a steely character. She's hard. She's seen so much, and she's showing her emotions. But I wouldn't say that was the moment. I think it was a totality of circumstances. She was very clear-minded. They went to New Hampshire with a very solid strategy of differentiating themselves with Obama, and she did a very good job. She did a fantastic job in the debate, in the New Hampshire debate. And on top of it, she showed her emotion. So it was a totality of circumstances.
All right, from political women to teen pregnancy.
Should teen moms get maternity leave from high school? The Denver Public School Board is considering giving 4 weeks maternity leave to new teen mothers, prompting a national debate on whether this condones teen pregnancy. If girls take unexcused leave after having a child, they can face detention, suspension, truancy notices, and eventually summonses to juvenile court. Nationally, teen pregnancy once again made headlines after a study out late last year shows the teen birth rate rose by 3% in 2006, that following more than a decade of decline.
Dr. Healy, how long does a woman need to, and I'm sure it's different for teenagers than it would be for a 40-year-old woman going through childbirth, but how long do teenagers need to recover from childbirth?
Well, I mean, it's many weeks. It might be 4 weeks, it might be 6 weeks, and we're talking about both a change in woman's body as well as her emotions, her hormones. I mean, this is a very tender time for women. There is a reason that they're given this time off. And I think it is ridiculous to say that you will determine whether or not someone gets attention, gets some sort of free time or some time to be with herself and her baby based on whether she's married or not or based on what her age is. This is ridiculous.
Well, so you're saying they should grant them maternity leave?
Of course they should. It's a health leave.
What is so remarkable in this case is that this girl went to the school to say, how much time can I take off? And they said, it is an unexcused absence. If you have that baby on Tuesday, you better be here on Wednesday or it will be an unexcused absence. And, you know, to think about the fact that teen pregnancy is a root cause of poverty in this country and that what happens to most kids who end up dropping out because they've had a child, if they've dropped out, they tend to have another child while they're a teenager, and then there is no helping them. The thing we have to do is make sure they stay in school, make it as easy as possible, and according to this plan, which is to give them leave, let them do their homework at home, give them their assignments, do as much as you can to nurture that education, because that's going to be the only way out.
All right, but you don't think that sends a nod that, you know, we're with you on this, we're going to give you all the benefits of, you know, that
it's a reward, that you get time off?
That's socially we're saying this is unwed motherhood is acceptable.
Exactly, and you know, the challenging part that you have here is the school system making these decisions. I mean, this is amazing. The school system is to educate kids, to discipline kids, to put them, and then they have to be making medical decisions and child, you know, maternity leave decisions. It's sort of the wrong place, but you know what?
No.
The school systems have to transform. I mean, they become more than just a place where people get educated, and these are hard issues that they need to face, and I am with them. I think when you punish the mother, you punish the baby. And for the long-term health of the individual and also of the baby, and to also put them in the right track, I think you need to have a flexible plan. I don't know if 3 months is the right time. I don't know if 6 weeks is the right amount of time, but it has to be flexible. It's impossible.
possible. The next day after delivery is completely unfair.
I think you alluded to the right part about whose responsibility and role is this, and I go back to the parents, because these are children who are having children, essentially. And I just have to say my little point here, if we had more school choice across the country, parents could make a decision whether to send their child to a school that had that program or not. But without that, the root cause
Well, actually,
children,
not no, in Denver. No, in Denver, the special school for unwed teen mothers is full. There's a waiting list.
No,
for
but
it.
If you
so
had more options, more school choice across the country, I mean, you can't say that it's pervasive enough where parents have enough options to meet the need.
You all don't think that when you have a teenager who, first of all, to send the students to schools where they're all in the same situation is one thing. To integrate into a high school full of predominantly not pregnant teen girls, that yes, she's there, she's finishing, and then she's also getting 4 to 6 weeks off from school.
Well,
not sending a message to young girls who are not pregnant in high school, go for
well,
it.
Well, first of all, staying, 4 weeks off from school is not a good thing, and it is not a good thing for her well-being, and it means that she's not participating in social activities. I mean, it should be made very clear you will not participate in social activities. This is about health. It is not about a reward. And I think we have to, at the same time, say that teen pregnancy is bad. It's bad for the baby.
No,
it's bad for the little girl.
Millions.
And we have. But to penalize that individual, we have to separate public health from the individual.
How do you separate it without condoning it?
Suppose a kid is involved in a car accident, and they've had alcohol, and they have a broken leg. They take some time off from school. Do you say, well, you have to come to school right away because we're not going to accept the fact that that was an accident? The fact is, when you have a patient, we're not talking about a person, we're talking about a patient, they need health attention, you've got to give
okay,
them.
Okay, well, let
you
me ask you this.
Don't punish people depriving them of health.
Where we start with giving the mothers time off, shouldn't the fathers be bonding with these
Wait.
No. Shouldn't the fathers also be bonding with these children in their immediate infancy? So don't you open the door for them to say, I want time off, too.
Bonnie, you're exactly right. I think you have a lot of parents who would be very upset to think that the school's making this decision, and it's, in some sense, penalizing their children who are kind of following the rule, learning about abstinence, they're trying to follow a certain path of guiding their children, and this makes it a very difficult conversation. But there are role models that we need in this issue. There needs to be more of a dialogue about the hazards of teen pregnancy
and
you don't see that. You don't have that conversation. Instead, it's okay. Nickelodeon wants to talk about doing a special maybe on teen pregnancy issue. This isn't the course in the
Well, you don't have it because the Bush administration is funding abstinence-only education, and a lot of kids aren't getting sex education.
But you know what that abstinence-only is? That's exactly what you're talking about. Shouldn't we be telling them they shouldn't have babies? That's what we're doing, and it's not working. And your argument to me strikes me very similar to the argument of those who say, if we give them birth control, aren't we condoning what they're doing?
It is similar. And the HPV Gardasil vaccine.
Right.
I mean, it is similar to that. But in
but
those cases,
Healy
I don't
says,
think it's legitimate.
We're having to
in
deal
this
with
case.
Realities. And the reality is we've had this fight between education and hormones,
but
and the hormones win sometimes.
Step back for a second. You don't think there's an element of creating more of those realities by condoning and helping the people who do make those
things. We have policies like abstinence only that have proven that are not working. Why do you keep putting the kids in the middle? The kids become the political pundits, and particularly this
pawns,
in terms particularly of teenage pregnancy.
Well, and also caring for a patient who has heart disease because they're a smoker doesn't mean you don't take care of smokers and
no, but on the other
smoking.
Hand, a lot of insurance companies and corporations are saying you're going to pay for the extra amount of your insurance that you cause, which does put more of the burden on the person for making that decision.
But
there are financial penalties.
But we're talking about health care of a baby and of the mother at that time. But we also should not be afraid of an important word called shame. This is a shameful thing because she has harmed a child. She has brought a child into the world that is disadvantaged the day it is born. We ought to start using social and cultural pressures. And I think that with regard to the individual health of that young girl and her baby,
We ought to take care of them, but we also ought to make it clear that this is a shameful act because it is an irresponsible one to another person.
And you expect the school
yes.
officials to say, this was a shameful thing that you did. I'm giving you a month off from school. I mean, come on.
No. The other thing is, you haven't had a baby. I'm telling you.
No.
It is, you know, it if you get a couple weeks off for getting your appendix out, I can tell you, you probably need that much time after you've had a baby. I mean, it's a pretty serious thing.
All right. We've beaten this one to death. Behind the headlines, online networking. Nearly 70% of the U.S. population is using the internet, much of that for networking. We all know about the web's impact on politics, uniting liberals, for example, on MoveOn.org, or conservatives on TownHall.com. But it's also particularly effective bringing together smaller networks of women who couldn't reach each other before. One such group is Texas-based Las Comadres, which links tens of thousands of Latinas in cities across the country. Founder Nora Comstock uses technology to link like-minded women.
For me, again, it goes back to the cultural experience that I was missing it, and through this experience, I was able to do it. Had a couple of colleagues in Austin who did the face-to-face gatherings. They're very difficult. There's a lot of work involved in making face-to-face gatherings happen on a monthly basis and do stuff like that. So I pulled it all together and blended it into the use of technology to bring us together on a monthly basis.
The internet enables Comstock to reach 2,000 women in her own city of Austin and tens of thousands more in 75 other U.S. cities. She emails her comadres on everything from job opportunities to book clubs.
I can send as much as 15 to 20 emails a day in Austin, which is my largest market because I'm there. 15 to 20 emails a day to 1,800 members, let's say in Austin, 1,800 members. And then if I'm sending it to other cities as well, because this is city-based, so I make a decision. Should this go to everybody? Should this only go to certain markets? Sometimes they're in English, sometimes they're in Spanish, and sometimes they do it in English and Spanish so that everybody can access the information.
The virtual connections lead to in-person meetings during social gatherings Las Comadres call comadrazos.
We start introductions going all the way around, starting with the hostess, and we ask them different questions. Different cities do it slightly differently. But basically, you know, your name, maybe your ethnic heritage. Are you Colombian? Are you Mexican? Are you Mexican-American? You know, where do you come from? Your family's here, maybe what kind of work you have, or if you're staying at home, or if you're looking for a job, you know, whatever you want to share. And it depends on the size of the group, how much you get to say. And we go all the way around the group. Everybody gets to be introduced.
These meetings create friendships, bring together job seekers and employers, students looking for scholarships, even fix-ups that lead to marriage. Comstock says while her group is for Latinas, she hopes other women would make connections in their own cultural communities.
When you leave a comadrazo, it's not about maintaining the Latino identity when you walk out of there in your little groups. Your job is to get out there and tell everybody, to share and to experience. I think other people should start the groups because it is a cultural connection. It is about your roots. It's about staying connected, but it's not about separation.
So you are part of this group. How has it changed your life? And which is how we found out about
exactly, it. Exactly. In so many ways, you know, it's being well studied that having networks and be part of an active community is good for your mental health. So I think it's been a great benefit for my mental health. But it goes beyond that. It's the gathering, it's the knowing other women, other Latina women, and coming together in that aspect of who we are. We're many things. We're women, we're mother, but we're also Latinas. And in so many cities, particularly, it tends to gravitate to more professional, educated Latina women. And we're all over the place, and many of us work in places where we're the only Latinas. So when we come together, we, you know, network in that side of who we are. And impact also in terms of a network that you can go when you want to run for office. We have a couple of candidates. It's a nonpartisan network, but we're there. And if people come and make their case, the volunteers may decide to support that candidate. So it works in so many different ways.
Oh, I find it outstanding. Like, we need another platform to connect Latinas. You know, we can find, if there's one, we'll use it. There's no doubt.
Well, is it equally true, do we know, of other religious, racial, ethnic groups?
Probably to some extent. What's interesting about it is, like, I know I've studied things like the Congress of the 100 Black Women, you know, the national conferences that were started. And I've talked to them about modeling those aspects within Hispanic communities. And now as the Latina community is maturing and, you know, moving more into the private sector and taking professional positions and just growing families, there's a lot of need and desire to have that networking bond that maybe wasn't so much there. Now that you have this young generation of young bloods who want to make the technology available, I think many people will continue to flock.
But I have to ask the question, do we run the risk by doing this by cultural heritage, by religion, groups such as these,
That's the internet. You invite and people organize in different ways, and that's part of our identity. But let me tell you, we don't exclude anybody. When we have the comadrazo, everybody's welcome.
All right. Sounds like a party. That's it for this edition of To the Contrary. Next week, actress and mathematician Danica McKellar gets girls interested in math. Please join us on the web for To the Contrary Extra. And whether your views are in agreement or to the contrary, please join us next time.
To the Contrary is supported in part by the Cardinal Health Foundation, funding national programs that enhance patient safety and access to quality healthcare services. Additional funding provided by the E. Rhodes and Leona B. Carpenter Foundation, the Jacob and Valeria Langeloth Foundation, the David Lynch Foundation, the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, and by the Ayrshire Foundation. For videotapes of To the Contrary, please contact Federal News Service at 1-888-343-1940.
We are PBS.